The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the edition dated December 2nd, 2011. Now from the main stories section, the first item is entitled, No Deal on Debt Reduction. What happened? The Congressional Super Committee, formed to forge a bipartisan deal to reduce the deficit, admitted defeat this past week, triggering an automatic $1.2 trillion in cuts to defense and entitlement spending next year. The panel of six Republicans and six Democrats did not even come close to a deal that both parties could swallow. Republicans refused to go beyond their proposal to raise $300 billion in additional revenues while cutting the top tax rate, and Democrats refused to make major cuts to entitlement programs without at least $1 trillion in new taxes. Super Committee member Senator John Kerry, the Democrat from Massachusetts, said Republicans repeatedly insisted they could not violate the pledge against raising taxes authored by conservative activist Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist has been the 13th member of the Super Committee without being there, Kerry said. Senator John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, said Democrats were only interested in raising taxes and failed to provide a plan for cutting Medicare and Social Security spending. Our Democratic friends were never willing to do the entitlement reforms, Kyle said. The Super Committee's failure to reach the deal triggered automatic 10-year sequestration cuts to the federal budget, including $454 billion from defense and $123 billion from Medicare. But congressional defense hawks are already exploring ways of undoing the Pentagon cuts before they kick in on January 1, 2013. President Obama said he would veto any attempt to alter or undo them. The only way these spending cuts will not take place is if Congress gets back to work and agrees on a balanced plan, he said. They've still got a year to figure it out. What the editorial said. Thank you, Grover Norquist, said the Wall Street Journal. The Super Committee's failure wasn't just a symptom of congressional dysfunction, but also a product of divided government and a clash of political visions. Democrats are sticking firm to President Obama's plan to expand government and raise taxes, while Republicans share Norquist's goal of cutting spending and the size of government. Voters will have to decide which direction the country should go. Sounds like we need an election. Even an election won't solve our deficit problem, said the Washington Post. It might give us a new president and a reshuffled Congress, but it is unlikely to produce a clear mandate for either party's vision of debt reduction. Our political system will still require the victors to compromise with the losers. So while the Super Committee's failure means that the debt reduction can has been kicked once again, there will be no deal until our political parties relinquish their ideological rigidity. Now here's what the columnist said. Where was the president during these negotiations, asked Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Major budget deals require presidential pressure and cajoling, but Obama contributed only a few phone calls and tepid public statements to the process. Obama obviously wanted the Super Committee to fail, said Alana Goodman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Since he can't run on his dismal record, he plans to blame the do-nothing Congress, and the Super Committee's failure gives him a ton of fodder for his re-election bid. It's absurd to blame Obama, said Derek Thompson in the Atlantic.com. Republicans reflexively oppose everything he suggests, and the idea that he could suddenly convince them to rip up their anti-tax pledges fails the smell test. The GOP never had any intention of compromising, said Andrew Rosenthal in NewYorkTimes.com. That's why they proposed a series of ever smaller cuts to the deficit, as well as a plan to cut tax rates for the rich. Their goal was is to sabotage any deal and keep the economy as weak as possible until Election Day 2012. Republicans may regret that calculated gamble, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. Obama now holds the Trump card, the dual-trigger nightmare of $1.2 trillion in sequestration cuts and the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts, both due in January 2013. Unless Republicans can get Democrats to sign on to a deficit reduction deal over the next year, the triggers will cut the deficit by more than $7 trillion over the next decade, with a 3-to-1 ratio of tax increases to spending cuts. That prospect, horrifying to the GOP, puts Democrats in the driver's seat. The next item from the main section of the Week magazine this week is Chaos in Cairo. Hundreds of thousands of angry demonstrators took to Cairo's streets this week to demand that Egypt's military rulers immediately hand over power to a civilian government. In Tahrir Square, riot police blasted protesters with tear gas, birdshot, rubber bullets, and, according to field medics, live ammunition. At least 38 people were killed and 2,000 wounded. In an attempt to placate protesters, Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tatani, Egypt's de facto leader since President Hosni Mubarak was overthrown in February, announced that presidential elections would be held next summer, a year ahead of schedule, and that parliamentary elections would go ahead as planned next week. The crowd in Tahrir Square rejected Tatawi's concessions, chanting, "Go, go, the people demand the overthrow of the regime." Egypt's junta has outstayed its welcome, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In the 9 months since they helped protesters topple Mubarak, military leaders have shown no willingness to relinquish power. Dates and rules for elections keep changing, and the generals have tried to shape the new constitution so that it will place them beyond civilian control. The Obama administration should now use its considerable influence. It hands Egypt $1.3 billion a year in military aid to force the generals to step down. But we shouldn't weaken the military too much, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. If the Muslim Brotherhood wins the upcoming elections, as expected, it will use any power it gains to ensure democracy and individual rights are doomed. The Egyptian military might be corrupt, but it has to remain strong enough to keep the Islamists in line. True, there are ample reasons to worry about an Islamist victory at the polls, said Shadi Hamid in TheAtlantic.com. They are not liberals, but letting the army retain control over the democratic process would be even more dangerous. Just look at Algeria. When the military there annulled a 1992 election after Islamists won, years of civil war followed. Bloodshed on that scale is unlikely in Egypt, but any attempt by the military to exploit the current chaos in a bid to keep power would be disastrous for Egypt's fledgling transition. And the next item from the main story section, Syria's Assad rebuked. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, fresh from a rebuke by the Arab League, appeared increasingly isolated this week after his one-time ally, Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, bluntly told him to step down, and the UN strongly condemned his regime. Invoking the bloody end of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, Erdogan warned Assad to remove yourself from that seat or risk suffering a similar fate. The eight-month uprising against the Assad regime, during which more than 3,500 people have been killed, escalated this past week with reports of military defections to the opposition and insurgent attacks on government offices in Damascus. In the western city of Homs, fighting has swelled beyond the minority Alawites, Syria's ruling sect, and the majority Sunni population, raising fears that the conflict could descend into all-out sectarian war. It's time for the butcher of Damascus to head into exile, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. If he won't go quietly, the U.S. and others should bolster the opposition and impose more sanctions in order to further tighten the economic noose. Military intervention shouldn't be ruled out. Yes, it should be, said Aaron David Miller in the New York Times. Syria is not Libya. The U.S. and NATO would be foolish to consider any military involvement in this fight. The Syrian opposition is inchoate and stunningly vulnerable, and the government's remaining friends, Iran and Hezbollah, would complicate any intervention. Assad's regime is rotten fruit, but it's not at all clear whether it's ready to fall. The best strategy is to keep offering Assad an exit strategy, said the economist. When he has felt threatened in the past, he has grown more murderous, but he cannot overlook the evidence that the diplomatic tide has turned against him. Even Iran betrays doubts over whether to stick with him. Syria's neighbors have everything to lose if Assad, feeling cornered, stokes a sectarian bloodbath to deflect the uprising against his regime. They now have to take the lead in convincing him to stand down and negotiate a way out of his murderous impasse. And now we turn to the controversy of the week entitled Occupy Wall Street. Will the crackdown end the movement? Is there life after occupation, said Aaron Gupta in Salon.com. In cities and at colleges across the nation this week, authorities continued to clear and dismantle the camps and tent cities of the Occupy movement, which began 2 months ago in New York City to protest inequality, corruption, and corporate greed. At the University of California at Davis, a campus policeman was filmed pepper spraying a line of seated, peaceful protesters, sparking widespread outrage and an apology from university officials. The images of crowds of everyday people confronting legions of cops protecting the conclaves of the rich and powerful can only help the movement. But with police cracking down hard, the question becomes, can an occupation movement survive if it no longer occupies a space? I sincerely doubt it, said L. Gordon Krovitz in the Wall Street Journal. From Oakland, California to Portland, Oregon to New York City, this so-called movement of entitled and sometimes violent young people has worn out the patience of even the most liberal cities. Local residents and businesses have wearied of the tent cities and their all-night drumming, people defecating into buckets, drug use, and crime. Free speech is one thing, sleeping in parks and downtowns is another, and defying the law and police is yet another. If these protesters can't get attention without disrupting law-abiding citizens, their message must not be very persuasive. Actually, the authorities just did the movement a huge favor, said Laura Washington in the Chicago Sun-Times. The camps that grabbed the world's attention so effectively in September were becoming known for more disruption and squalor than results. Now, however, with the dangerous disarray of the camps out of the picture, the occupiers have no choice but to get off their air mattresses and get something done. Don't count on it, said Mike Gavin in WSJ.com. Many optimistic liberals are predicting that the occupiers, like the conservative Tea Partiers before them, will now focus their energies on getting candidates elected to Congress. But that will be impossible unless somebody takes charge, narrows the focus, and identifies what exactly they want charged. The Occupy movement had two long months to come up with an agenda, said the New York Post in an editorial, but all it offered was resentment, envy, and entitlement. Having worn out everyone's patience, the movement has irrevocably passed its sell-by date. The Occupy movement does indeed have a central idea, and a powerful one at that, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. It's that our financial system has been warped to serve the interests of a privileged few at the expense of everyone else. To be more specific, the 1% who control much of the nation's wealth have rigged the game, using campaign contributions to buy tax loopholes and relaxed regulation from Washington, and awarding themselves monstrous bonuses while while laying off vast armies of the middle class. The protesters may not have supplied a point-by-point political agenda to redress that unfairness, but they've done something more important. They've gotten the 1% versus 99% idea into people's heads. Thanks to the occupiers, said David Carr in the New York Times, the 2012 election may well be fought over the issue of economic fairness. If so, those who slept in parks, sat through endless General Assembly meetings, and got roughed up by cops will know that though their tents are gone, their footprint remains. And now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the popular section, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for never giving up on love. After 83-year-old Paul Trito of Kansas City, Missouri, tied the knot with 96-year-old Fern Schuer. Suddenly, there she was, and it became evident that she was the one I wanted to be with, said Trito. It's never too late. You're never too old. And it was a good week for never giving up. After Pat Moorhead of Long Beach, California, spent his 80th birthday jumping out of a plane 81 times. You don't stop skydiving because you get old, said Moorhead, who's done 6,000 jumps. You've got to keep moving. And it was a good week for metrosexuals after a British study found that men now spend 81 minutes a day on personal grooming, including shaving, washing, moisturizing, and picking out clothes. Women spend only 75 minutes a day on personal grooming. And it was a bad week for fish stories after Massachusetts fisherman Carlos Rafael accidentally caught an 881-pound tuna in his trawl gear. When he reported the catch, worth up to $400,000 on the sushi market, to fishery officials, they seized the giant tuna and told him he'd broken the law because he hadn't used a rod and a reel. And it was a bad week for free speech after Pakistan notified phone companies it would ban 1,109 obscene English words from text messages, including quickie, condom, flatulence, and period. And it was a bad week for typos after James R. Butler of the Derby, Connecticut Finance Board was listed on an election ballot as James J. Butler, his son. Officials say that James J. Butler won the election and should be sworn in. My son wants nothing to do with this, said Butler. And now, from Good Week, Bad Week, we will turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. And the first item here is entitled, Simmons Busy Savvy. Gene Simmons is best known as Kiss's tongue-waggling bassist, said Catherine Knight in the London Daily Mail, but he's also a very canny businessman. Over four decades, Simmons has accrued a $160 million fortune selling Kiss merchandise and setting up online firms and running a financial planning service for the super rich. The music business was always just that, business, he shrugs. If you're in it, you have a duty to take care of yourself. Otherwise, it's going to make short work of you. It's not very far from headlining an arena to living in your mother's basement again. The son of a concentration camp survivor, Simmons was raised dirt poor in Queens, New York. As a young man, he worked two jobs while putting together Kiss. He has little sympathy for the Occupy Wall Street protesters. What they're arguing about is they don't have jobs. But there are plenty of jobs, he says. It just may not be the job you want. Too bad. Anyone can get rich, he adds, by following a few simple rules. Never a lender or a borrower be. Avoid credit cards. It's common sense. But people don't have common sense, they have greed. The next item is entitled The Accidental Poisoner. The novelist Nicholas Evans once declared, "Guilt is my subject," said Decca Aitkenhead in the London Guardian. That was before the evening in August 2008, when the horse whisperer Arthur almost killed half his family. Since then, he says, I've taken my research to a rather extreme degree. Evans and his wife Charlotte were staying with her brother and sister-in-law in Scotland when Evans picked and fried some wild mushrooms for supper. Within 24 hours, they were all in the hospital fighting for their lives. One by one, they went into kidney failure. They survived but remain on dialysis. Evans' 29-year-old daughter, Lauren recently persuaded him to accept one of her kidneys, but everyone else is still waiting for a donor. Although Evan's wife has forgiven him, family relations are not good. It doesn't help that they can't agree whose fault it was. I did pick the mushrooms, but it was really two people, each thinking the other one knew what he or she was doing. He won't identify the other guilty party. It's really hard to talk about, he says, pausing to consider his words. I can't go into this. It has caused us too much pain. Can he see things improving? I don't know. Maybe when we're all better. I think that will help enormously when everybody's got a transplant. And the next item, Keaton's love for Woody Allen. Diane Keaton was besotted with Woody Allen long before they met, said Teerdad Darakshani in the Philadelphia Inquirer. My family used to gather around the TV and watch him on Johnny Carson, she says. He was so hip with his thick glasses and cool suits. In 1969, the actress appeared in Allen's stage comedy, Play It Again, Sam. They fell in love. He couldn't help himself. He loved neurotic girls. But Allen never knew the true extent of Keaton's insecurities. Whenever possible, she'd wiggle out of their dates. Then, in the privacy of her apartment, Keaton would eat enormous amounts of food, a bucket of fried chicken, piles of French fries, and a whole pound cake, and vomit. The demands of bulimia outshone my desire for Woody, pathetic but true. Allen had no idea about Keaton's condition, but suspecting she was depressed, suggested she visit a psychoanalyst. After 18 months of treatment, Keaton started eating normally again. Keaton and Allen broke up soon after, but she still holds a torch for the director. I miss Woody. He'd cringe if he knew how much I care about him. But what am I supposed to do? I still love him. And now we'll turn to the weekly feature, The Briefing, from The Week magazine. This week's article is entitled, Obsessed with Children. The sexual abuse scandal at Penn State has raised awareness of pedophilia. How do these predators operate? What is a pedophile? It's an adult with a sexual preference for prepubescent children, typically 13 or under, of either sex, though some prefer one gender. The term can be used to describe anyone who fantasizes about, is sexually aroused by, or experiences urges toward children, whether or not they act on them. Most psychologists believe that people with pedophilia will eventually act on it in some way, by exposing themselves to, spying on, or sexually touching children. About 4% of the population is believed to have pedophilic urges. Psychologists now categorize it as a sexual orientation much like heterosexuality and homosexuality, in the sense that the sexual attraction to children appears to be involuntary and remains stable over time. Pedophilia is also treated as a disorder, of course, because pedophiles who act on their urges cause grievous harm to young children, leaving them with emotional scars that can last for decades. What kind of people are pedophiles? Most are male, though about 6% are female. Although the stereotype of the pedophile is trench-coated loner who hangs around playgrounds, in reality, most pedophiles function as ordinary members of the community, like former Penn State defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky, the man accused of sexually abusing children in his care. About 44% of convicted pedophiles either are or have been married, and a vast majority of pedophiles have sexual relationships with adults. Only 7% say they are exclusively attracted to children. The majority of child molesters do not abuse children at random. For all the worries about stranger danger, 70% of reported abuses involve an offender who knows the child, including relatives. What goes through their heads? Most pedophiles are driven by strong feelings of love and tenderness toward children, say psychologists, rather than a desire to hurt them. They romanticize children, seek out their company, and convince themselves that their feelings are mutual. It's not just sex, it's romance, said psychologist Dr. Leslie Lothstein. They're in love with the five-year-old. Many take voluntary positions or jobs that allow them to be close to children, such as scout leader, coach, or priest. Pedophiles usually select targets carefully and groom them over a period of months with gifts, attention, and special trips. Only then, after gaining the child's trust, do they initiate sexual contact. Pedophiles often feel guilt and shame about their activities, say therapists. People don't grow up and say, "I want to be a pedophile," said the Reverend Stephen Rossetti, who runs a psychiatric hospital near Washington, D.C. "All the people I've ever talked to hate it." What causes pedophilia? It's not clear. It's commonly thought that those who were sexually abused as children are at high risk of becoming pedophiles, but only one-third of pedophiles admit to having been abused. Other kinds of emotional trauma in childhood, research suggests, may also lead a person to get stuck in an early stage of emotional development. Researchers who've studied pedophiles' brains have found abnormalities that cause low impulse control and obsessive behavior. But the cause remains something of a mystery, just like much of human sexuality. What happens when pedophiles are convicted? The average jail sentence handed down to a convicted pedophile is 11 years, but several states go beyond simple jail terms. Florida, Louisiana, and California now allow or mandate chemical castration for sex offenders, drugs that suppress testosterone and quash sexual appetite. Texas even allows a judge to recommend surgical castration if the offender gives consent. But the punishment doesn't end with the sentence. All 50 states have reporting laws requiring sex offenders to register with local authorities so that their whereabouts can be monitored. Megan's Law, a federal mandate named after a 7-year-old girl who was raped and murdered in 1994, requires that a community be notified if a sex offender lives there. Though the law remains controversial, reporting requirements seem to have helped. In a recent 15-year period, sex crimes against children declined by 53%. Can pedophilia be cured? No. There's no magic cure that can make the sexual attraction to children go away, and up to 50% of convicted pedophiles reoffend. But the drug addiction, gambling addiction, and other destructive obsessions, pedophilia can be successfully treated if pedophiles are motivated to stop their behavior. The most common treatment for pedophiles is release prevention, a lifelong therapy similar to alcoholism treatment that conditions them to live with their obsession and not act on it. Some clinics offer aversive conditioning or shame therapy, which forces pedophiles to associate with urges with something painful or pleasant, such as an electric shock. There are also other drugs that can suppress a pedophile's sex drive. With the right combination of drugs and therapy, pedophiles can learn to resist their urges, said Dr. Fred Berlin, founder of the Johns Hopkins Sexual Disorders Clinic. We're not going to be able to put out the fire, he said, but we can do a nice job of containing it. The dangers of the Internet, that's the carve-out section here in this particular briefing. The Internet has given sexual predators a new way of finding victims, but most of these predators are not technically pedophiles. About 99% of the sex crimes committed through Internet-initiated contacts involve the statutory rape of teenagers rather than little children. Pedophiles, who by definition prefer children who have not reached puberty, rarely meet victims online. But the Internet does give them a forum to communicate with one another. European and U.S. police recently busted 70,000 members of an online message board where pedophiles exchanged child pornography and stories of abuse, along with justifications for their behavior. This kind of community allows pedophiles to avoid admitting that their desires are harmful and illegal, said former police commander and anti-pedophile campaigner Bill Walsh. That can allow them to take that final step and cross over fantasy into real-world oftenness. I need to correct that sentence there. It was, that can allow them to take that final step and cross over from fantasy into real-world offenses. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for December 2nd, 2011. Thanks for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. this week, according to the Week magazine. The first one is entitled Gingrich's Total Lack of Scruples, written by Jennifer Rubin in the WashingtonPost.com. Does character matter to Republicans? Asked Jennifer Rubin. Some of my fellow conservatives have now turned to Newt Gingrich as the latest desperate alternative to Mitt Romney. But throughout his career, Gingrich has demonstrated an almost total lack of character, temperament, and personal rectitude. The former House Speaker has admitted cheating on his first two wives with much younger aides, but says Bill Clinton was worse because he lied about his affair under oath. Quite a campaign slogan, never committed perjury. Gingrich's hypocrisy knows no bounds. He took $1.6 million from mortgage giant Freddie Mac and hundreds of thousands more than the ethanol lobby and Big Pharma, yet insists he was paid for his expertise as a historian, not as a lobbyist. This is delusional. His smug self-regard is also troubling. He considers every thought that pops into his head brilliant, and so proclaimed this week that we should eliminate child labor laws. We've already learned from Presidents Nixon and Clinton that electing a dishonest, self-deluded, and undisciplined, and personally disloyal, what else is infidelity, president is a nightmare. Let's not repeat that mistake. The next column is entitled, Giving Up All Hope for Mideast Peace. And this is written by Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. No one has made a formal announcement, said Trudy Rubin, but the Israeli-Palestinian peace process of the past two decades is dead. Israeli leaders don't believe peace is possible. Palestinians have given up on dealing with Israel, and President Obama has turned his back on the issue he once championed. How did we arrive at this dead end? In 2008, then-Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert created a workable framework for a Palestinian state after extensive discussions with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Olmert proposed returning all but 6.3% of the West Bank to Palestinian control, while Abbas countered with 1.9%, a gap that could have been closed with further talks and land swaps. But Abbas stalled on accepting the deal, Olmert stepped down, and Israel moved much further to the right under Benjamin Netanyahu. After some bull in a china shop diplomacy that eroded trust on both sides, Obama has given up. Now Israel is sliding toward a one-state solution in which Palestinians within Israel's current borders will eventually outnumber Jews. This ensures perpetual violence and an ugly reckoning down the road. And the next column is How Kids Learn to Hate Real Food by Kristen Wortman in HuffingtonPost.com. Kids won't eat vegetables, so you might as well let them subsist on French fries and industrial pizza. That, said Kristen Wortman, was the logic Congress used last week in killing new Department of Agriculture guidelines that would have increased the amount of fruit and vegetables in school lunches. After large food companies such as ConAgra and Schwann spent $5.6 million lobbying against new nutrition guidelines, lawmakers let schools continue to count French fries and the tomato sauce on frozen pizzas as vegetables. It's not the job of the nanny state, say conservatives, to tell people what to eat. But government doesn't control what kids eat. Corporations do. through Big Food's relentless advertising and its monopoly on school cafeterias, kids are so conditioned to the taste of sugary, salty, and fatty food products that vegetables, fruit, and other real food seem bland by comparison. Is it any wonder that one-fifth of four-year-olds are obese? Thanks to ConAgra and its pals in Congress, our school kids right to feast on frozen pizza and fries has been protected. And now we'll flip to the back of the magazine The Week this week for the very popular section entitled The Last Word. This week it's entitled specifically The Great Pretender. Before Jerry Sandusky was accused of molesting children, he boasted of living in a make-believe world. The college football world knew him as the Dean of Linebacker U, the defensive coach who helped Penn State win two national championships. But Jerry Sandusky saw himself as a great pretender. It was a name he adopted while performing in a band at his annual summer football camp of children. Pretending has always been a part of me, Sandusky, now 67, wrote in his autobiography, Touched, the Jerry Sandusky story. I've loved trying to do the right things to hopefully make a difference in kids' lives and maybe make things better off for them. I'll never regret being called a great pretender. 2 weeks after prosecutors charged him with sexually molesting eight boys he befriended through his charity, some of Sandusky's friends, fans, and former players are wondering, did the great pretender fool us all? They are combing their memories for missed signs, clues that could have tipped them off that the coach they once assumed was Joe Paterno's heir apparent may not have been who they thought he was. His book provides a glimpse of a man who is not very introspective and admits to his own immaturity. He talks a lot in that book about hugging kids, about loving to be around kids, said editor David Newhouse, whose newspaper, The Patriot News, broke the Sandusky story. There's some chilling things in that book, and it's only when you put them together with the allegations that you can see, perhaps, what he meant. Sandusky has denied the charges outlined in a 23-page grand jury report and insisted he is not a pedophile in an interview last week with NBC's Bob Costas. But he also said he enjoys being around kids, always has. He says he has helped hundreds, if not thousands, through his charity, The Second Mile. Beyond the sex acts and assaults, the grand jury report portrays Sandusky as both controlling and needy. He called one boy more than 100 times after the boy started avoiding him, according to phone records examined by authorities. Sandusky describes himself as a harmless, overgrown kid. He writes that even beyond his drive to win and perform good works, he has a tendency to push too hard, to go too far, and get himself in trouble with his pranks. I believe I live a good part of my life in a make-believe world. I enjoyed pretending as a kid, and I love doing the same as an adult with these kids, he writes. When a person rises to great heights and then crashes, the search for answers begins with a look at his childhood. Sandusky demonstrates an exceptional fondness for the years he spent as a boy in Washington, Pennsylvania, a small mining town tucked in the state's southwest corner, about 30 miles from Pittsburgh. His parents, Art and Evelyn, ran a recreation center, and the family lived in the upstairs apartment. The center was known as the Brownson House, taking its name from a benefactor, a local judge. Sandusky called it the Bug House because of the colorful characters who came by. He was an only child, but at the Bug House he never lacked for company. One of his constant companions was a mentally challenged boy everyone called Big Ern. I used to take Ernie to the movies, or we'd go swimming together, and I taught him how to play basketball, he recalls in the book. His father coached football, basketball, and wrestling and worked hard to embody the slogan on a sign in his office. Don't give up on a bad boy because he might turn out to be a great young man. He tutored neighborhood children and took in trouble kids, giving them chores and making them feel important. Artie had strength and leadership and charisma, says Larry Roboski, who became a local basketball star under Art Sandusky's wing. Jerry Sandusky was not a leader type guy as a teenager, says his boyhood friend Bill Lindsay. He remembers Sandusky as somewhat aloof. But high school football provided his ticket to Penn State, and Sandusky headed off to Happy Valley to play defensive end for the football team. He married Dottie Gross in 1966, the year he graduated from Penn State. He met her at a picnic the previous summer, and although he was shy and awkward around girls, his mother pushed him to pursue the relationship. After brief coaching stints at Juanita College and Boston University, Sandusky returned to Penn State for good in 1969 and stayed through 32 seasons. He and Dottie bought the house they live in today and were happy to settle in State College. It seemed the perfect place to raise a family. When the children learned they could not have children of their own, they were heartbroken. They soon turned to helping other people's kids. They adopted six, Kara, the only girl, and boys, EJ, John, Jeff, Ray, and Matt. Three of the children arrived as infants. Three were foster children, at least two of whom came through the second mile. John and EJ played for the Nittany Lions. Matt was a team manager, and Kara graduated from Penn State and worked there. Sandusky's two big passions, football and kids, came together in 1977. That year, he was named Penn State's defensive coordinator, and with the proceeds from his football book, Developing Linebackers the Penn State Way, he established the Second Mile. It began as a group foster home for eight boys, but grew over the years into a statewide program with an annual budget of more than $1 million, offering after-school programs, mentoring, and, according to the charity, free camps to 100,000 children. I was happy beyond my wildest dreams to be known as Penn State football coach, Sandusky writes, but I wanted to do something similar to what my parents did in that recreation center when I was a kid, how they reached out and extended themselves to so many young people. The children from the Second Mile became known around campus as Jerry's Kids. He brought them to training table dinners, introduced them to Penn State's coaches and players, took them to games and picnics, bought them gifts, and wrote them letters. Before every home game, the coaches and players loaded onto buses at the practice facility and rode to the stadium as fans stood by and cheered. Sandusky always had a Second Mile boy with him. There aren't many programs that would put up with that, he told the Center Daily Times, the newspaper in State College in 2002. I will always be grateful for that. Despite the 32 years he spent roaming the sidelines with Paterno, Sandusky's references in his book to the legendary coach seem to lack any measure of intimacy. He does say that Paterno yelled at him a lot, noticing his penchant for practical jokes early on. Sandusky recalls how Paterno summoned him to his office in the late 1960s to scold him. I would like to be able to recommend you for future coaching jobs, but I don't want to recommend a guy who's going to act like a complete goofball. Except for his wife and daughter, Sandusky hardly mentions women and girls in the book. Instead, he refers time and time again to special boys he has grown close to over the years. They meant as much as, if not more than, football. Sports fans often say Sandusky is the best coach never to head a team. Indeed, the great pretender turned down opportunities to become head coach at Marshall University, Temple University, and in 1991, the University of Maryland. He says he couldn't bear to part with his foster children or leave his Second Mile kids behind. I am tough and competitive with the kids, he writes, but the one thing that has never pretend or make believe about me is my genuine love and care for the kids. NFL Hall of Famer Franco Harris, who served as an honorary board member for the Second Mile, said, "We all believed in what Jerry was doing." The news of the Sandusky investigation first surfaced last spring. The Patriot News in Harrisburg reported that a grand jury was looking into allegations of abuse, mentioning just two boys. Sandusky, it appears, attempted to do some damage control. According to the grand jury report, he called one young man, he had not spoken to him in 2 years, in the weeks before his accuser was to testify. His wife and a family friend phoned, too. The calls were never returned, the report says. Matt Hahn, who played for Penn State from 2004 to 2007, recalls seeing Sandusky around a lot, though the coach had retired in 1999. He usually had young boys with him, but nobody suspected a thing. Hahn had a strong reaction to a suggestion by Sandusky's attorney that hugging in the showers was what jocks do. "Let me make one thing clear," Hahn says. "There's no hugging in the shower between any guys, and nobody is rubbing my back, and I'm not rubbing anybody's back, I can tell you that. You hear a 60-year-old man who is showering with a 10-year-old boy, that's enough for me to say, whoa, that's not a good thing." Sandusky's old friends back in Washington, Pennsylvania, are having trouble reconciling the boy they knew with the man many now consider a monster. The brick rec center, once run by his mother and father, remains on Jefferson Avenue. The Brownson House still serves the community, but not to the extent that it once did. Minds have closed, families have moved on. Residents who revere Sandusky's father were proud to see Art's boy grow into a leader at Penn State. Now this. It brings Larry Romboski, who was mentored by Sandusky's father, to tears. The big question is, why? Why? Why would he do this, he says. His parents have such a great reputation, and why would he in any way try to ruin that? The ruins extend far and wide. The scandal tarnished Paterno's legend and cost him his job. Penn State's longtime president was ousted, and the athletic director and the financial officer stand accused of perjury and failing to report what they knew to authorities. The Second Mile has announced that it is considering three options for its future, one of which is dissolution. More potential victims have come forward. The man at the center of it all, the great pretender, reveals little of his psyche in his book, but there are legions now searching his word for answers. At the times when I found myself searching for maturity, the coach writes, I usually came up with insanity. That's the way it is in the life of Gerald Arthur Sandusky. And that article was written by Ann O'Neill and Wayne Drash. And Sarah Hoy and Jesse Joseph also contributed to the article. It was first published by CNN. And now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item here is entitled American Exceptionalism, an Idea in Decline. Belief in American exceptionalism is rapidly fading away, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. As recently as 2002, 60% of U.S. citizens surveyed said they agreed with the statement, "Our people are not perfect, but our culture is superior to others." But with our economy in tatters, our debt rising, and our foreign interventions producing frustration, Americans' belief in our innate superiority has fallen to 49%, below a majority for the first time. In fact, we're now only a few points ahead of Germany, 47%, and Spain, 44%. We are settling into a dangerous national pessimism, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. It's even deeper among Americans younger than 30, just 37% of whom believe they live in the world's best nation. That should send a wake-up call to our political leaders, who should stop snuggling up to the nostalgia for a time when the U.S. economy and military dominated the world, and get back to making hard choices and investing in our future. You choose greatness, it doesn't choose you. The public may be disenchanted, said John Gans in The Atlantic, but this is springtime for the idea of American exceptionalism among our political class. The Republican candidates for president have all pledged their passionate commitment to the concept that America has a unique, divinely decreed role as a global leader. And while it may come as a surprise to Republican voters, President Obama has talked more about American exceptionalism than Presidents Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush combined. But what Republicans remember, said Richard W. Stevenson in NewYorkTimes.com, is that Obama once said, sure, he thought the U.S. was exceptional, but the Brits and Greeks think they're exceptional, too. That might not satisfy voters longing for a return to the America they once knew. Like it or not, said James Kitfield in National Journal, America's half-century of world dominance is now over. With China and India ascendant, wealth and power are passing from the developed West to the developing East. The Romans once thought they were exceptional, too, said Christopher Hitchens in Slate.com, as did the British at the height of their own empire. Such pride invariably presages a fall. You'd think that American conservatives, mindful of what the Bible teaches about the sin of pride, would be particularly wary of self-proclaimed historical uniqueness. The next item is entitled, Piracy Bill, a Death Sentence for the Web? Does Congress want to kill the Internet? Asked the San Jose Mercury News in an editorial. If lawmakers pass a proposed new law called the Stop Online Piracy Act, the freedom that created companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Yahoo will be gone. This draconian legislation would give the government and copyright owners the power to shut down websites suspected of illegally sharing or selling movies, music, and other copyrighted material. What's more, those sites' owners would be held financially liable for any infringements. So if one rogue user posted bootleg footage of a Lady Gaga concert on YouTube, the government could shut down both YouTube and its owner, Google. To comply with this draconian law, said Rebecca McKinnon in the New York Times, sites like Google and Twitter would need to employ thousands of people to monitor and censor user content. Does the U.S. really want to become China? No, but we don't want to become the Wild West either, said Robert Levine in Salon.com. For three centuries, the work of writers, artists, musicians, and other people who create our culture has been protected by intellectual property laws. Virtually overnight, the Internet has rendered those laws powerless, and pirated content of all kinds is now available in a few keystrokes, with firms like Google complicit in these copyright variations. Google's search engine, for example, can lead you to newspaper articles and pirated music and movies that rightly belong to the people who created them. Google then sells ads to run alongside the list of stolen content, generating billions of dollars, while newspapers, publishing companies, the music industry, film studios, and other traditional media companies wither. If artists can't charge for the culture they create, they'll create a lot less of it, and everyone loses. But even if the new anti-piracy law passes, said Jerry Brito in Time.com, history suggests that it will quickly become moot. Back in 2000, the government easily closed illegal music-sharing site Napster by focusing on its centralized computer server. Napster's successor, BitTorrent, however, is hosted on millions of computers around the world, so it can't be shut down even if it's found to be illegal. And computer whiz kids are working on even more sophisticated tools for sharing digital content in defiance of any central authority. The more governments try to control the Internet, the more it will turn to sand around their fingers. The next article here, Conservatives, the Quest for Ideological Purity. Republicans have developed a purity problem, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Every candidate in the current presidential field has been thumped by conservatives for any position they've ever taken that conflicts with the right's current orthodoxy. The same whack-a-mole primary process that hammered Rick Perry for his decision to educate immigrants' children and Herman Cain for supporting the TARP bailouts will now turn on Gingrich for acknowledging in 2008 that climate change was real and supporting an individual health insurance mandate in the 1990s. With the conservative media now egging it on, the GOP has adopted a form of fundamentalism, the belief that a return to power can be achieved only by a return to purity. That's a tragic misreading of history, said Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com. Republicans didn't lose the elections of 2006 and 2008 because they weren't conservative enough. It was among independent voters that Republicans got slaughtered. If the candidate we run in 2012 is too far to the right, we'll get slaughtered again. Conservatives want to win elections, said William Kristol in the Weekly Standard, but we want to win with a candidate who will actually stand up for core conservative principles. That's why we keep resisting media darling Mitt Romney, who has compulsively flip-flopped on ethanol studies, union bargaining, and abortion. Conservatives had to swallow the centrist John McCain in 2008, said Richard Viguerie in RealPolitics.com, and before that it was both Bushes, Bob Dole and Jerry Ford. This time we want a real conservative who will draw a clear contrast with Obama and the big spending, big government liberalism he represents. Someone like Ronald Reagan. As a lifelong Republican, I fear that the search for such purity will destroy my party, says David Frum in New York. Today's GOP insists that more tax cuts for the rich will cure everything, that poor people are lucky duckies because they pay little in taxes, and that any attempt to reform a broken health care system is socialism. If you disagree with the party's flight from reality, you're attacked as a rhino, a Republican in name only. By today's standards, even Reagan would be branded a rhino, said Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com. Don't forget, he was condemned by hardcore conservatives for making deals with liberals, Democrats, and the Soviets. If even Reagan is too moderate for today's GOP, conservatism will shrink to a rump movement doomed to lose every national election. And now as we reach the end of the program, let's listen to a few smaller notes in the news here. Social Security disability benefits paid to people who can no longer work more than doubled between 2001 and last year when they totaled $124 billion. The program may run out of reserves in 7 years. 40% of Americans at some point work for the same firm that employed their fathers, according to a study in the Journal of Labor Economics. But as a father's income increases, so does the chance that his child will work for the same company. In the top 1% of highest-earning Americans, 7 out of 10 sons take a job with their dad's employers. The Environmental Protection Agency has tested just 200 of the 80,000 chemicals registered in the United States. The total number banned is 5. A software security firm has isolated 25 worst passwords to use online. These included 123456, QWERTY, QWERTY, Let Me In, and the worst is simply password. And now let's take a look at the poll watch for this week. Americans continue to be divided about the Occupy Wall Street movement, though more disapprove of the way the protests are being conducted. 24% say they consider themselves to be supporters of the movement, while 19% say they are opponents. And 53% say they're neither. 31% now disapprove of the way protests are being conducted, up from just 20% last month. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time. We'll